The Source Podcast is brought to you by TechPont, a San Antonio company that uses cutting-edge digital technology to elevate marketing and advertising campaigns while reporting on transparent, measurable results. Their custom-built marketing strategies offer complete digital solutions and management. TechPont strives to help businesses connect with customers and effectively grow businesses. More at TechPonte.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Could these be the waning days of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare? It provides health insurance to millions of Americans who otherwise couldn't afford it. A lawsuit by red states, including Texas, could have the ACA ruled unconstitutional. But what would that mean for the millions who depend on the Affordable Care Act and its reforms? Call in with your questions and comments. The number is 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org. Tweet at us at @TPRSource. We're joined right now with Sarah Cliff, the investigative reporter covering health policy for The New York Times. Sarah, welcome to The Source.
Thank you for having me.
Nicholas Bagley is with us. He is a professor at the University of Michigan Law School and former Department of Justice official under the Obama administration. Nicholas Bagley, welcome to The Source.
Happy to be here.
So, Nicholas, if you could tell me what is going on with this appeal, what is the argument and where are we?
Yeah, so the basic argument is that when Congress in late 2017 passed the tax reform law that it enacted, it zeroed out the mandate penalty. And by zeroing out the mandate penalty, it kicked the constitutional legs out from under the individual mandate, because back in 2012, the Supreme Court said that the mandate was only constitutional because it was enacted pursuant to Congress's taxing power. So if there's no longer a tax attached to the mandate, then the mandate can no longer be constitutional. And the argument goes further, that because the individual mandate that Congress somehow left on the books is unconstitutional, the entire Affordable Care Act has to fall. Now, I should just say right out of the gate, like, this is all a very strange argument. When Congress eliminated the penalty, what it meant to do was eliminate the mandate. That's what the president said. That's what members of Congress said. That's what everybody understood it to be doing. So this lawsuit is making a pretty adventurous argument about what Congress really wanted to do.
And it was Supreme Court Justice John Roberts that really came up with the argument that it was a taxing power that gave the Affordable Care Act its constitutional ability, right?
Right. So the chief said, you know, I'm not sure you could adopt the individual mandate under the Commerce Clause. I think that would be unconstitutional. But because it looks and walks like a tax, we think Congress could properly adopt it as a tax. And what we think Congress really did is give people a choice, either buy insurance or don't buy insurance and pay a tax. And so the question is now, what should we make of Congress's handiwork now that it has eliminated the penalty? The natural inference would be that you still have a choice. You have a choice either to buy insurance or not buy insurance, and there's no penalty at all attached to the choice to go without. The red states are arguing that what Congress meant to do is make the individual mandate even more coercive because it eliminated the choice to go without insurance. Now it just says you must buy insurance. You shall buy insurance in the language of the statute. And that seems pretty strange to me and to most observers who've taken a good look at this case.
But what about the tax being zero? Does that mean that you don't have the taxing authority if you're taxing at zero? Zero is a number.
Right. So one argument is actually this is still an exercise of the taxing power because, as you say, all it does is impose a tax, but it's a $0 tax. You could write a $0 check to the IRS. That argument also makes considerably more sense than the argument that the red states are pressing, which is that Congress meant by eliminating the penalty to make the individual mandate even more coercive because people feel compelled to adhere to the law and have no free choice in the matter. That argument, I think, just doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Well, this is all fun in academic sense, but when it comes to the real world where people depend on the Affordable Care Act to help them get health care, what happens to them? Sarah Cliff, you've looked at this at the New York Times. How many people are we talking about?
So most estimates are that about 20 million or so people are getting health care coverage through the Affordable Care Act. Most of those are actually through the Medicaid expansion, the provision that expands public coverage to low-income Americans. Those people are not living in Texas because Texas is one of the 14 states that has not expanded Medicaid. And then you also have a decent number, a number in the millions of people who have health insurance through healthcare.gov, through the state-run marketplaces. It would be just a huge, huge deal to have the Affordable Care Act turn back at this late in the game. At this point, it's a law that's been on the books for 9 years. You know, millions of people have purchased health insurance. It has made so many changes to how Medicare pays for health care. It would be a really massive task of unraveling the Affordable Care Act that would fall to whoever is president should the courts decide that is what they want to do.
You've written about how some people love what they get out of the Affordable Care Act, but they don't support it politically when they go vote. Do you think that those people will be surprised to find eventually that they no longer have the coverage that they enjoy and they have no idea why that happened?
I think they probably will. Probably most Americans are not following this lawsuit as closely as people like Nick and I are. They're kind of going about their day-to-day life. And as you mentioned, I've written about areas of the country where Obamacare is really hated. President Obama was not popular, and neither was his health care law. But places where a lot of people have signed up for Medicaid expansion in particular and have been pretty happy with that coverage. And I think if, this is something that did move forward and we did end up with a Supreme Court decision overturning the Affordable Care Act, that's about 20 million people who would be at risk of losing their health insurance and I think would be facing a pretty abrupt change in their lives.
One of those states, Kentucky, usually comes up as folks there like their program. It's not branded Obamacare, but Mitch McConnell's home state that he represents, but they could find out that they're going to lose that plan.
Yeah. I've actually talked to the former governor of Kentucky, Steve Beshear. He likes to tell this story. He was the Democrat who rolled out the Affordable Care Act in his state. They call their program to get health insurance Kentucky Connect. And he was at a state fair standing at the Kentucky Connect booth, and someone came up to him and said, I love this Connect coverage. It's so much better than Obamacare. And he decided not to tell that person that, well, actually, it is Obamacare. He figured the important thing is just getting people signed up for coverage. So I think you have seen in some of the conservative states, particularly those that have adopted Medicaid expansion, it's often called something else. It's not promoted as Obamacare. A lot of these people are getting health insurance cards with the name of a private insurer, the name of the state. So it's not super easy to see that this is Obamacare that you might be enrolling in.
So we could end up with the case of the dog that finally caught the bus and doesn't know what to do with it. Nicholas, what are we looking at if this gets pulled away, if Obamacare is ruled unconstitutional really quickly?
Yeah, well, there are the practical consequences that Sarah pointed to. There's also the political fallout, right? If this law were to be invalidated, who bears the blame? What pressures would you put on the political system? I mean, the practical consequences would be so huge that it's hard to know exactly. But I think the 2018 midterms really suggested that Republicans are on the defensive when it comes to the charge that they are trying to eliminate protections for people with pre-existing conditions. And this lawsuit would just confirm that charge.
They're on the defensive on that end, but they are playing offense in trying to get the Affordable Care Act ruled unconstitutional in the courts. Texas leading the charge with a coalition of red states. What will happen? We've heard from some of our politicians, including Texas Senator John Cornyn, saying that they will respond with some sort of plan, but what? We'll try and figure that out when we come back from this break. You've got a question, call in. The number is 210-614-8980. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.
One of the hardest moments in Chicana writer Sherry Moraga's life was coming out to her mother.
She said to me, "Is how could you think there was anything in this life that you could do that you wouldn't be my daughter?" And I think that's all we need to hear.
Moraga joins us on Fronteras to talk about her memoir, Native Country of the Heart. I'm Norma Martinez. Download Fronteras wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. In the next half hour, we're going to be talking about Alamo Colleges beginning to offer its free community college program to high school graduates here in Bexar County. We'll have the details on that coming up. But right now, we're talking about the Affordable Care Act and legal challenges to that. What happens if they are successful? What will that mean for healthcare access and also some of the reforms of the Affordable Care Act? What's been your experience with coverage through the Affordable Care Act? What do you want to see happen with a healthcare law in the United States? What are you looking Are you considering these things as you shop around for the presidential candidates? Call in 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Nicholas Bagley, professor at the University of Michigan Law School, a professor and a former Department of Justice official. Is all this kind of surprising to you, Nicholas, that this fight is still going on right now? That is this an ideological battle?
Yeah, you know, I think there were a lot of folk who thought that once the Affordable Care Act was rolled out, Republicans would find a way to make their peace with it. Even if they didn't like it, it would become part of the broader sort of landscape of the healthcare system. And that really hasn't happened yet. We saw the Republicans take another run at the ACA after Trump was elected. We see them pressing forward with this lawsuit. I do wonder if, you know, I think at this point, there are a lot of Republican, you know, politicians in Washington who don't really want to talk about this lawsuit. And I think they'd prefer in their heart of hearts that it would quietly go away because it may complicate their election campaigns. I mean, this case could be pending during the 2020 presidential election. It could be a serious drag on Trump's popularity. So, you know, am I surprised? Yeah, I suppose so. But boy, experience with the ACA suggests that I shouldn't be surprised about almost anything.
We have asked Texas Senator John Cornyn about what would happen if this lawsuit is successful and the ACA is ruled unconstitutional. And we've got a really broad answer about, well, we will come up with something that will be even better and then the ACA. Sarah Cliff, as you cover this as an investigative reporter covering healthcare policy for The New York Times, any idea what he's talking about?
No, because I was here in 2017 when Republicans were working very, very hard to repeal the Affordable Care Act. And by say here, I mean in Washington and spending a lot of time up on Capitol Hill. And I think one of the things we saw in 2017 is that Republicans did not have a health care plan that their caucus could agree on. You know, they tried very, very hard. They devoted the greater part of a year to repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act. And there was just nothing that could move through Congress that could do that. Now, it might be the case if we had a Supreme Court ruling that invalidated Obamacare, that might light a bit of a fire to come up with a plan and agree on something. But right now, there's no evidence that I've seen that Republicans have a plan, and none of the plans they, you know, pursued in 2017, I'd add, would cover as many people that are currently covered under the Affordable Care Act.
But to do that, there are several hurdles that would have to be accomplished. I mean, you might be able to find a coalition between Republican and Democrats in the House and the Senate who could get that done, but then it would also have to be signed by President Trump. So that's a pretzel, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, there is no easy road to replacing the Affordable Care Act. And, you know, one of the things I think of, you know, the Affordable Care Act is almost like an octopus with so many tentacles and so many different things. Most of us know it for giving coverage to additional people, for revamping the private health insurance market, but it also changed the way that Medicare pays providers. It's the reason there's calorie labels when you go to Starbucks that tell you how many calories are in the muffin. It's funding a bunch of different public health programs. So it's just such a massive sprawling law that has had 9 years to really settle into the American healthcare system. Coming up with a plan to undo and remake and figure out an exit strategy from all that, it's really difficult. And I have not seen that plan produced by Republicans so far.
It would be some sort of Brexit type of thing. Let's go to Victor on the phones. So the number is 210-614-8980. Hey, Victor, welcome to The Source. Thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Hello, hi. Well, I guess my comment on this subject is I cannot begin to understand how we can support something that would eliminate coverage for people with pre-existing conditions. we're basically telling those people that even though we know they're running out of time, that they're going to have to just either lay down and die or do something else because they have no recourse if they don't have coverage.
All right, Victor, thank you for that. Nicholas Bagley, professor at University of Michigan Law School, former Department of Justice official. Is this also going to take away the protections for pre-existing conditions?
Yeah, absolutely, right? That's one of the principal targets of the lawsuit. And it's one of those ways that, when Republicans say things like, we support protections for people with pre-existing conditions, you want to ask them, well, what are you doing to follow through on that purported commitment? And when you actually look at what they're doing, well, they're throwing their weight behind this lawsuit, which is designed specifically to strip away those protections. So their promises ring to my ears pretty hollow. And it looks to me like they're trying to use the courts to achieve what they couldn't actually achieve through Congress, right? Congress thought about whether to repeal the Affordable Care Act. It tried very hard, as Sarah said, to repeal the Affordable Care Act and replace it with something wonderful. And they didn't have the votes. They couldn't do it because it turns out that in enough quarters, the Affordable Care Act is popular enough because it does provide essential protections to people. So the notion that the courts would now intervene to do what Congress couldn't bring itself to do strikes me as an effort to enlist the courts in a kind of conservative judicial activism.
Back to the phones with Maureen. Hi, Maureen. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm just curious, what's with the rhetoric of everybody loves their insurance companies? Because I don't see that, and I've researched it heavily. If we had single-payer health care, everybody would have a 2.2% payroll tax. Employers have, I think, 6.3% or something percent, and that's it. And then you can walk in any hospital. Everything stays the same. It's just a matter of financing without Joshua Kushner making $5.7 billion. And he started that company.
Okay.
With $10 million and now he's worth $5.7 billion, where's that? Why do we have to give them that our money in order to get health care?
All right, Maureen, thank you for that. So like Bernie Sanders says, people don't want to pay taxes, but they love paying for those health insurance premiums. And he says that doesn't make any sense. Sarah Cliff, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think like the caller was saying, there is a growing movement for single-payer healthcare in the United States. If you look at the polling on this, you see over the past 20 years or so, a slow, steady uptake of more people who would support having a government-run healthcare system, no private health insurance. It's becoming a huge, huge issue in the Democratic presidential primary. You saw in the debates, candidates both nights were asked, would you eliminate private health insurance? And we had four different candidates raising their hands saying, yes, they would. Who knows if, like Nick said, the area of Affordable Care Act litigation and policymaking is very unprecedented and hard to predict. You know, one possible outcome of tearing down the Affordable Care Act is maybe this is what Democrats offer in replacement as the way that they would go forward from a world where the Affordable Care Act no longer exists. I'm not saying there's a clear path to that. It's a long, challenging path. But I think this energy behind single payer is growing, and it grows more and more as Republicans keep continuing to attack the Affordable Care Act.
So, Nicholas Bagley, how about that? Would having the courts come in here, although it would be disruptive, it would take away health care from people, and that's never good, but would that clear the field for putting in something new and maybe more comprehensive, depending on who gets elected and what happens in the next presidential election? Who knows what happens?
Yeah, look, it would be an enormous shock to the system. And, shocks to the system yield unpredictable results. So, yeah, the path might be open to some broader change of the healthcare system, but there are serious political obstacles to getting there. I think the caller is right that there are very few people who love their insurance, but I think there are a lot of people out there who get their insurance through their employers and are happy enough with it and would be worried if there was a Medicare for All plan that might shunt them into some kind of government-sponsored insurance. Some people would be okay with that, but a lot of people might be squeamish. And as soon as Medicare for All becomes a realistic possibility, you're going to have physicians and hospitals and patient advocacy groups and drug manufacturers and everybody coming out of the woodwork to potentially object. And so I think there are serious obstacles, even as Sarah is totally right, even as enthusiasm grows for Medicare for All on the left and across the country.
The healthcare industry, a major part of the economy, having it thrown into disruption, unpredictability, that's not good for people who they just can't stop taking their meds for months or even a year or more because we can't get this thing figured out. All these things have a consequence, Nicholas.
Yeah, they really do. You know, I get emails, I'm sure Sarah gets even more, from people worrying all the time that their coverage might be, you know, ended and not sure what they're going to do next. The kind of uncertainty is not only bad for people, it's also a drag on the whole broader healthcare economy. It's hard for insurers to write plans that they can price effectively and low, you know, at a low price, if they're not sure if they're going to even be in business next year, because there's this sort of Damocles hanging over the Affordable Care Act.
Let me check in with Sarah on that. Sarah, are you hearing from people? Are you sensing a fear and dread about what's going on here?
Yeah, you know, I covered, like I said, the repeal effort pretty closely in 2017. And, you know, I got to know particularly patients with significant medical needs, those who might have faced a lifetime limit on their health care coverage before Obamacare eliminated those in 2010. I think they just kind of have gotten used to this constant state of worry where their health coverage seems very on the line year after year. We've been in this debate much, much longer than most of us had thought. You know, like Nick was saying, I had expected, you know, I've been covering the Affordable Care Act since it passed, and I thought this controversy would die down. And I do hear from people who, you know, are asking, especially when these court rulings come out at the lower level, I start getting tweets and emails being like, oh my gosh, is my health insurance going away? And it isn't, is what I try and reassure people. But might it go away next year? That's a real possibility that I think patients have to think about.
So, Nicholas, right now this is being looked at in appeal in New Orleans, but then it would probably go to the Supreme Court?
If they were to invalidate all or a big part of the Affordable Care Act, I think there is every chance that the Supreme Court would take the case. The Chief Justice of the United States is the fifth vote for that you'd need in order to invalidate the ACA. And on two prior occasions when he had a chance to take a whack at the Affordable Care Act, he declined to do so. And those challenges were way stronger than this challenge. And they were much earlier, but you know, long before the ACA became quite as embedded as it did in the rest of the healthcare system. So if the composition of the court remains the same, I think there's every reason to think that the lawsuit is unlikely to succeed at the Supreme Court. But we can't say for sure.
And what about the fact that we do have politicians who are taking this case to the courts, trying to get the ACA tossed out without really thinking about the human cost of it? Should there be some sort of accountability for that, Nicholas, or at least, you know, recognition?
Yeah, of course, right? That this is reckless and irresponsible to think that you'd upend 18% of the economy through a court ruling without having any kind of exit plan, any kind of debate about what might replace the Affordable Care Act. This is a shocking dereliction of responsibility on the part of the red state attorneys general that think that you can rip the ACA off like a Band-Aid and move on with your life. It just does not work like that. And to see the Trump administration, which is charged with upholding the laws, which is charged with enforcing the laws, to come out and say, we also think the entire ACA should be invalidated, I'm at a loss to think how responsible governors, responsible policymakers could go along with that.
All right. Nicholas Bagley is a professor at the University of Michigan Law School, former Department of Justice official. Also with us, Sarah Cliff, investigative reporter covering healthcare policy for The New York Times.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia, and Jan Ross Piedad. Dan Katz is TPR's news director.